most weren't. Many seemed normal, some looked totally bonkerballs. I recognized a few faces from my romp through The Watchdogs. As I was about to log off, mind numb with fatigue, my eyes roved over three images filling the screen. One picture showed a middle-aged man behind a podium, wispy white hair poorly concealing a shiny pink scalp, glasses the size of bagels. Above his left shoulder, a portion of a banner. Ferenc on MK Ultra and Mind Control, 2010. The second was a group shot following what may have been a panel presentation. Three men, one woman, all with plastic-encased badges pinned to their chests. I recognized no one. The third was a candid of maybe 20 people closely packed and oblivious to the camera. The angle wasn't great, catching mostly profiles in the backs of heads. It looked like an image captured by a mobile phone or camera held high with no attempt at framing. The men were in off-the-rack suits, the lone woman in a Walmart Women's Plus red dress and fake pearls, a party or reception of some sort. Farthest from the lens, detached from the crowd, three men stood, visible from the shoulders up. They were deep in conversation, heads tilted, unaware of their part in an iPhone or Kodak moment. Two of the faces were caught full frontal, making me wonder if one of them had been the focus of the photographer's interest. The third stood obliquely, features hidden. The man on the left was the tallest of the three, probably mid-40s. He wore military-style glasses and had wavy brown hair side-parted and combed back from his face. A text box had been inserted into the picture below his chin. It said, Yates Timmer. The man turned away was short and stocky, with thick black hair that spilled over his collar. A text box gave his name as Nick Body. Holy shit. There he was, looking younger than in any of the more recent photos I'd seen. I shifted to the third man in the trio and lurched forward in my seat. It was Felix Vodyanov. A June bug beat against the screen. I pictured it small and bronze in the moonlight. I'd listened to it for hours, crawling up, falling away, returning with a buzzing clunk. Trying over and over to do what? Weren't June bugs supposed to be gone after sunset? Had it been a single insect? Or had I heard a succession, struggling, failing, being replaced? The digits on the clock said 8:05. The window showed a montage of greens below a hazy sky. The beetle was gone. Had it been real? Or had I dreamed it as a metaphor for my frustration? It's a sick feeling being in exile, unable to go home. But at last, I had a lead, a maybe lead. Totally pumped from what I'd seen online, I considered driving to Slidell's home. It was Sunday morning again. I doubted he'd answer a call from me. Instead, I snatched my mobile from the nightstand, went to the privacy settings, and switched off caller ID. Then I dialed Slidell. The ploy worked. I got this number on every do not call list on the planet. You're now blocked. I'm a cop. I hear from you again. You're going to the can. Share my sentiments with the skeevy ass outfit that's paying you. It's me, I said. Do not hang up. Slidell sucked a quick breath. I shut him down. Felix Vodyanov knows Nick Body. What in the name of sweet Christ are you talking about? I found a picture of them together in 2010. The internet wingnut and the dead perv? Yes. Where? At a conference on mind control. You said Body don't like paparazzi. Dubious. I told Slidell about the dark web and the deep undersight. Apparently, someone spotted Body in the crowd, maybe an admirer, maybe an opportunist hoping to score with a shot, who knows. I recognized Vodyanov from the composite sketch. You're sure it was him? Yes. So the two know each other. The link being this conspiracy shit? Vodyanov was into it. Conspiracy theories are Body's lifeblood. Slidell did the thing he does in his throat. They were with a third man identified as Yates Timmer.
What kind of pussy-ass name is Y...
Can you run him? See if anything pops?
I'm just heading out to work something.
A lead on Jahan Cole?
No. I'm looking into maybe D.B. Cooper's buried under Panther Stadium.
I said nothing. Long-suffering sigh, then...
An old woman living near the Cole home called the tip line saying a car circled the block twice around 2 a.m. the night before the kid went missing. Apparently, the old biddy don't sleep so well. Anyway, her call slipped through the cracks.
Slipped through the cracks?
There's no ref to a follow-up, no interview report. I did some digging. Turns out Granny was 83 back then. Shortly after that, her kids parked her in an old folks' home.
Assisted living. With an appropriate note of reproach.
Whatever. We're going to have a little chat.
Have you spoken to her?
Nope. Could be her circuits are scrambled.
Could be hers are sharper than yours. I didn't say it.
You'll look into Yates Timmer as soon as you're back?
Sure. In the meantime, I'm certain you'll have at him on the weird wide web.
I did, as soon as I'd brewed coffee and fed the cat.
I needed no deep net browser to find Yates Timmer. No password. Links to his website popped up with good old Google. Timmer was a realtor with properties to sell. Not ranch homes in Modesto or condos in Fort Wayne. As I clicked through listings, my jaw literally dropped.
Chapter 18. Timmer's business was called Homes at the End of the World, LLP. The homepage was set up much like that of Deep Under. Tabs across the top offered four options. About me, contact me, properties for sale, property video tours. Below the tabs, I specialize in the acquisition and sale of missile bases and underground structures. Under that startling statement was a pair of before and after aerial shots. On the left, looking militaristically stark, was a Nike missile base built in 1954, decommissioned in 1965. On the right was the same property in 2014, now lushly landscaped with hedge-lined walks, driveway, and pond. A flat concrete roof till could be seen just breaching the surface at the center of an expanse of unrelentingly green grass. Beneath the two pictures, a sales pitch. The properties I represent give new meaning to the word hardscape. Hard escape. Underground bunkers, hidden missile silos, buried command centers. These subterranean strongholds provide the ultimate in safety and privacy. They assure solitude and security in violent and troubling times. Once converted, such complexes are ports in any storm, be it actual war or simply the frenzy of 21st century life. Far from the beaten path and safe from calamity, they are truly homes at the end of the world. Designed by the Department of Defense and constructed with enough reinforced steel and impenetrable concrete to survive a nuclear attack, underground missile bases and silos are some of the strongest buildings in existence. Such structures redefine the words bomb shelter. And what an investment opportunity! Given climate change and today's highly volatile political situation, both domestically and internationally, these prized and very limited properties are rapidly appreciating in value. Act now, and I can make one yours. Selecting the tab labeled About Me produced a picture of Yates Timmer. Same military-style glasses, but the wavy hair was thinner, the dress more casual than at the Mind Control Conference 8 years earlier. Wearing jeans, a safari bush jacket, and boots, Timmer stood with arms crossed, legs spread, in a tubular tunnel with walls of corrugated steel. Behind him, rocket-shaped coach lights flanked a studded steel door. A brief bio described Timmer as a retired Army engineer, specializing in the niche market of underground military structures. His background included the exploration of nearly 100 sites and the sale of more than 40 properties. Timmer was described as an expert at converting subterranean complexes into residences, having spent 20 years transforming a missile base into a home he called World's End House. I clicked on the
worldsendhouse.com link and found myself looking at the after photo featured on the page I just left and an overview of the property's grim history. World's End House began life in 1954 as part of the Nike Ajax project, a surface-to-air defense system, SAM, developed by the Army Air Defense Command, a RADCOM. Eventually, the Ajax was replaced by the improved Hercules missile, and Nike Ajax bases became Hercules sites. A gradual decrease in Nike deployment began in 1967, and by 1975, with the SALT II Treaty, a RADCOM itself was deactivated. World's End House is now a 27-acre estate located 40 miles south of Manhattan, Kansas. The missiles are long gone, and the structure has been converted into a home in which Yates Timmer has lived since 1998. Tours are available, and World's End House can be rented for special events. I took the video tour. Timmer narrated as the camera moved up and down dizzyingly steep steel stairs, across massive open spaces, past rusty metal entities about whose function I hadn't a clue, eventually into rooms with cheap paintings, factory-made oriental carpets, and brightly colored rooms-to-go furnishings, striving to be cheerful within miles of windowless concrete. Living room, bedroom, institutional-sized kitchen. As he passed through, Timmer explained the original function of each. Missile magazine, personnel safety room, mechanical room, storage area. After 20 minutes, Timmer re-entered the outside world, exiting through a one-foot-thick entry blast door. Behind him, the camera caught the small mountain of earth now concealing the Cold War relic that was his home. The lawns and walkways, the perimeter fence. The video shifted to a montage of abandoned bases similar to World's End House. Nike, Titan 1 and 2, Atlas ENF, communication bunkers. As the footage moved from one listing to the next, Timmer spooled through a sales pitch, touting the desirability of underground living, discreetly concealing prices and locations. Some properties were wooded, some barren. Some had been landscaped, others remained as they'd been when mothballed by the DOD. But a configuration of common features linked them all. A synapse fired red hot in my brain. Dots connected, a vision of real estate emerged. Not waiting for Timmer's closing remarks, I dialed the number on the screen. A recorded voice confirmed that I'd reached Homes at the End of the World, apologized for being unavailable, and requested that I leave my name and number. I did. Throwing on sneakers, jeans, and a tee, I grabbed a long-sleeve shirt and headed out. Images kaleidoscoped as I made my way back to Cleveland County. The Google Earth bird's-eye view of the acreage down the road from Duncan Keesing. The mound at its center. The security camera and keypad. The overkill fence. Questions rode with the images, some old, some new. Was the site an abandoned military base? The apartment in Ramos's building appeared to have been used solely for storage, perhaps as a safe house. Was a converted silo or bunker Vodyanov's actual home? Why? Keesing said he'd occupied his trailer for 12 years. Was he aware of the history of the neighboring land? If so, why didn't he tell me? Vodyanov knew Yates Timmer. Had Timmer arranged for him to use the property? Who was listed as the owner with the Register of Deeds? Nick Boddy knew Yates Timmer. Where Boddy lived and worked were closely guarded secrets. Might the place be Boddy's home? His studio? Might he record his outrageous podcasts there? Vodyanov had known Boddy for at least 8 years. The MK Ultra conference had taken place in 2010. Both knew Timmer. All three were interested in conspiracy theories. Was that their connection, or did the link go beyond that? And, for the zillionth time, how had Felix Vodyanov ended up dead on Buffalo Creek? And how the hell was I going to get through the gate? Arriving at the fenced property, I backed into the drive and parked with the front bumper facing the road. Slipping the shirt on over my tee, I climbed out of the car.
Undeterred by Friday's storm, the heat had rolled its sleeves up and committed to a personal best. A record-breaking 105 degrees Fahrenheit was predicted for the afternoon high. I stood with arms out, in full view of the camera, sweat glands already clocking in. As before, no one questioned my presence. The gate proved easy. It wasn't fully latched. A little pressure with one hand and it swung inward. Careless? Overconfident? Either way, the behavior was consistent. Vodianov had kept copious notes and carried them on his person and in his car. He'd left the keys to the Hyundai on the front tire, acts that showed neither a concern with nor aptitude for tight security or clever concealment. Based on the Google Earth capture, I estimated the distance to the clearing at roughly 50 yards, the earthen mound another 20 beyond that. Before proceeding, I paused to text Lydell. The message failed to send. Either lack of signal or juice in my phone. Turn around? Not a chance. My curiosity was like a force field driving me forward. Keeping my mobile in hand, I started up the drive. The thick mesh of leaves and branches blocked all sunlight, lowering the temperature and creating an atmosphere of perpetual dusk. Though far from cool, my skin prickled. Again, the forest seemed ominously still. No locust whined in the foliage, no creature stirred in the underbrush, no bird took flight overhead. I spotted no tread mark in the gravel, no rut in the narrow strip of dirt skimming each edge, nothing to indicate the passage of a vehicle. In minutes, the driveway ended in an odd hexagon, hosting only some very optimistic grass and brush. Where the brush thinned, I could see gravel, here and there a straight ribbon of gray that was probably an old walkway or drive. Off to the left, the remains of a shed, one wall barely upright and leaning precariously, the other three collapsed into a jumble of rusted tin and weathered boards. At the far end of the hexagon, the strange-looking rise. I paused, recalling Affordable Art and his Remington. The clearing offered zero cover. If someone was present and armed, I'd be an easy target. I checked my watch. 1:45 p.m. Hello? Nothing. Is anyone there? More nothing. I stepped from the trees. The sudden onslaught of sun caused me to squint. The closer I got, the more detail I could make out. The mound was shaped like an enormous flat-topped Quonset hut. Though an overlay of soil softened its outer contour, an angular hardscape was evident beneath. My archaeologist's eye said the thing was definitely not the work of Mother Nature. Additional clues were the steel girders surrounding its perimeter and the camouflage netting stretched across them, the type used by the military in woodland settings. I had no doubt the mound was man-made, or the purpose of the camo. Someone wanted the structure and any vehicles parked beside it hidden from aerial view. The ploy had worked. On Google Earth, the setup had appeared as an unremarkable rise in elevation. I was struck by the same somber thought I'd had at Ms. Ramos's building. If this really was Vodianov's place of residence, he wouldn't be here. He was lying on a gurney in the MCME morgue. Hevner's morgue. Blood pumping, I crossed the last few yards and stepped under the netting. The near blackness forced my constricted pupils into a rapid about-face. Anyone home? No response. I crept forward, using the flashlight app on my phone, stopping every few yards to listen, to shout. Slowly my vision adjusted. I made out a wall some distance ahead. In the wall, a dark rectangular outline, maybe a door. As I moved, objects leaped from the gloom in the glow from my screen. A backhoe, a front loader, other machinery that might have been meant for farming or construction. A bent bicycle wheel, stacked metal bins, dumpsters. Each article threw an elongated shadow version of itself before dissolving back into darkness. In less than a minute, I reached the wall. The rectangle was a blast door similar to the one in World's End House. I illuminated the concrete in small sections,
Saw no handle or latch, no buzzer or bell, no camera. Knocking was futile. I knew from the Timmer video that the door was a freaking foot thick.
Crap.
Swallowed by the suffocating heat and darkness trapped under the camo. I felt stymied. What had I expected? A little glass box with a cake saying, "Eat me," spelled out with currants? I spent a pointless moment chastising myself for wild-goosing, as Slidell would say. Myself took issue, arguing that the trip hadn't been futile. The nature of the property was now clear. Suddenly, I tensed. Pressing the phone to my chest, I went totally still. 10 seconds. 30? Had I imagined the sound? Then I heard it again. Dear God in heaven, I wasn't alone. Chapter 19. Someone was there. Something? Scritch, scritch. Reflexively, my free hand flew to my mouth. The noise stopped abruptly. The renewed silence was worse. Unseen eyes were watching, ears listening. I stood in the darkness, heart banging, mobile mashed to my shirt. Run? Try resending the text? Maybe here I'd pick up a signal from inside the bunker? Yes, reverse order. I tapped the screen, felt crosshairs on my back, my illuminated face. Still no go. I was cursing again when a shadow detached from the closest dumpster, a cigar-shaped object, clamped in its jaws. An image sparked in my brain. Glistening teeth, a bloody goose head. A nanosecond, then relief. No gun-wielding psycho had me in his sights. But what? The creature seemed too low to the ground to be a dog, too large to be a rat. And the Macanudo? I shone the phone toward the dumpster. The raccoon froze. Banded eyes wide, it gave a juddery chirp, then scurry-dashed for the safety of the outside world. The limbic buzz almost caused me to laugh. Almost. In his panic to haul ass, Groucho had dropped his prize. It lay in the dirt, fuzzy and ill-defined. Curious, I walked over for a closer look. The coon hadn't been enjoying a fine Cuban. Of course it hadn't. It had been rummaging for food. I bent and lifted its discarded booty. 2 bone fragments lay in my palm, their combined length approximately 6 inches. Each had one end terminating in jagged spikes, the other in a clean-edged break. Gripping the phone with my teeth, I raised the fragments into the light. Both showed areas of charring, suggesting burning. The splintered end of each was scored and punctured, suggesting scavenging. No way to know which had come first. The borders of the clean-edged break were pale and unstained, suggesting that trauma was recent. I tried fitting the 2 pieces together. They aligned nicely. I was holding a mid-shaft section of long bone, its only surviving anatomical feature, a sliver of articular surface rimming one AWOL joint. The sliver's wavy texture told me the limb had still been growing when its owner had died. A grim thought sent a rush of goose flesh up my arms. The bone's small size and cross-sectional shape were consistent with those of an immature human tibia. My mind was fighting that horrifying possibility when my eyes caught a hint of red embedded in a crack running from one shattered extremity. Blood? Drawing the fragments closer to the phone, I made out a tiny shred of fabric patterned with flowers or dots. Pause? Had the coon been lunching on the remains of a child? Was I looking at a scrap of teddy bear PJs or superhero briefs? Mouth dry, fingers sweaty slick, I laid down the bones, switched to camera mode, and took several shots, flash strobing bright in the murky gloom. That done, I slipped the fragments into my shirt pocket and stepped to the dumpster into which the coon had been diving. Groucho hadn't been messing around, or more accurately, he had. Garbage spread out in every direction, strewn like wreckage after a cyclone. Trash, the detective's best friend. Up close,
I could see that the dumpster was made of steel and green plastic, had wheels, and was accessed through a slanted front-loading lid. The lid was up, another indication of carelessness, or Procyon dexterity. I leaned over to peer in. The stench blasted me like a sirocco, a blend of liquefaction, fermentation, rot, and microbes. Covering my mouth and nose, I lit the bin's interior. Groucho's gang, the abundance of scatter suggested accomplices, had been selective. Left behind were non-edibles and articles too heavy to mine. A woven vinyl and metal chair, a globe with a broken base, a leather shoe, light bulbs, empty containers, Windex, Mr. Clean, Clorox, Gatorade, cardboard boxes, rags, lengths of pipe. I snapped a few shots with my camera app and backed away. Hoping for clues to the occupants or purpose of the bunker, I moved among the items littering the ground. Saw gnawed slices of pizza, pasta curling like ghostly white worms, Ziplocs oozing unidentifiable sludge. At the far end of the mess lay an eviscerated drawstring plastic bag, innards fanning out as a smaller debris field within the larger. Among the bag's displaced contents were foil packets, styrofoam cups, cardboard baskets, and waxy wrappers from Taco Bell, Burger King, and Bojangles dinners. Of more interest, a manila file, grease-stained and covered with putrefying beans, fries, bread, meat, and garnish. I wove my way to the folder and, using a plastic knife, flipped back the cover. Inside were the mangled remains of newspaper clippings, most deteriorated to mushy clumps resembling flattened tofu. Breathing through my mouth, I teased out the only two intact enough to retain legible copy. Each had been cut from a larger page, leaving neither a date nor the name of the paper. Centered in the first clipping was a head and shoulders color shot of a blonde-haired, green-eyed boy. Gaps in his front dentition suggested an age of 6 or 7. The boy was looking straight at the camera, smiling stiffly, a potted palm at his back. I guessed it was a school portrait, first, maybe second grade. Below the portrait ran the caption, "Timothy Horschhauser, still missing after 5 years." What remained of the accompanying story was lost to a slurry of ketchup, mustard, and mayo. The second surviving clipping had fared even worse. The coons and condiments had destroyed half of the picture and the entire article. Still, I recognized the photo's subject. The caramel skin, the dreadlocks bound with bright pink beads. Jahan Cole. Anger starts like a match flaring in my chest, spreads like wildfire roaring through dry grass. I felt the tiny hot flame. Upper incisors vising onto my lower lip, I spread the file's soggy contents and took shot after shot, blind to my subject matter in the dark. The tunnel was bake-oven hot, the only sound the soft click of my phone. Outside, far beyond the camo, a muted whine, there, then gone. Suddenly, the low battery warning filled my screen. Crap. A few more pics, then I carefully regathered the whole slimy mess. Tucking the folder under one arm, I rose, hoping the clipped articles, along with the bone fragments, would be enough to justify a search warrant. Exiting the camo elicited more pupil retrenchment. I scanned while walking, hand shielding my eyes. The clearing was empty, filled with the same silence echoing everywhere but inside my chest. The sun had dropped and was now skimming the tree line. In the late afternoon shadows off to the right, I noticed a blackened cylinder rising to the height of roughly 5 feet. Its walls were constructed of horizontal steel bands with open slits between. A vegetation-free zone circled the base, a mix of gravel and cinders. I suspected the thing was a home incinerator. Somehow I'd missed it on my inward charge toward the bunker. The source of the charred bone in my pocket? I made the short detour. 2 yards out, I smelt burnt paper, smoky wood, and melted plastic. Not pleasant, but not as bad as the decaying organics I'd left behind. The raccoons had also worked their magic here, but not with the same enthusiasm as at the dumpster. Or maybe it was a human hand, sloppy while emptying the ashy dregs. Several blackened hunks lay helter-skelter, too twisted and distorted to identify. Not so a small duct-taped pouch. Though it was obscured by the shadows and covered with soot, I recognized the fabric. Not daisies or polka dots. Rabbits doing handsprings and somersaults against a field of red. I dropped to my knees, set the folder aside, and began thumbnailing the end of the tape. Badly heat-seared, the adhesive refused to budge. I gouged deeper, again and again, my perspiration falling as small dark blotches on the acrobatic bunnies. No go. I kept digging, oblivious to the heat and carnivorous insects, to my surroundings. Finally, a corner yielded. I tugged gently. Millimeter by millimeter, the sticky tape lifted, taking with it a fold-over flap that covered the pouch's upper border. I shone my light into the interior. Two incisors and two molars lay along the bottom seam. The small size of the former and the bulbous cusps and slender divergent roots of the latter told me the teeth had belonged to a child. I stared, stunned that I'd found even more potentially incriminating material. Had I literally just stumbled across the very proof I needed to obtain a warrant? When does that ever happen? I wanted to grab the pouch and rush to my car. Instead, I forced myself calm and ran a mental checklist of proper protocol. Leaving the evidence in situ would be best, but far too risky. I'd take the pouch with me. Before removal from the scene, I'd document its provenience. First with establishing shots, the bunker, the clearing, the incinerator, then the pouch positioned to allow a close-up peek at the contents. I glanced at my screen. The battery icon was alarmingly short and red. The digit said 320. Hoping enough juice remained, I tapped the camera app and backtracked a few yards into the clearing. I was focusing the final shot when an elongated shadow swept across the frame. Human, but distorted. Irrationally, my mind popped an image of the looming Easter Island statues. I whirled, saw nothing. Had I imagined it? My eyes swept a 180 across the trees, the gravelly brush, the fallen down shed, the incinerator, the debris. Damn. I rushed forward, desperate to be wrong. I wasn't. Disbelieving, I stared at the spot where I'd placed the folder, at the spot where I'd left the pouch. Neither was there. I'd heard no car engine, no footsteps, no movement at all. How is it possible? And who the hell would take them? And why? Mental cringe at the reaming I'd get from Slidell. After a fruitless 10 minutes searching the area, I aimed my phone for one final shot. It was dead. Out of here. I'd just passed through the gate when something hard whacked the back of my skull. I started to pivot, but a kick struck the small of my back. I fell, my phone dropped and slid across the gravel. A second kick struck my side, fast and vicious. Pain exploded in my ribs. Gasping, taste of dirt in my mouth, vision afloat with black dots, I rolled to my back and looked up. A figure stood above me, a dark silhouette backlit by shafts of coppery orange sun. The silhouette was slender, about my height, a long, thin implement in its hands, a baseball cap on its head. I couldn't tell the gender of the wearer. I struggled to rise, a foot mashed down on my chest.
What the fuck are you doing here?
The voice sounded wobbly, like wind passing through fan blades. That same tiny chime in my hindbrain. Had I heard it before? Too freaked to be cautious, or disoriented by the blows, I snapped back, "Who the hell's asking?"
"None of your goddamn business."
Slurry at the edges. Was the guy drunk? High? "I'm here officially," I panted.
"You're a fucking liar."
Without thinking, I grabbed the ankle and wrenched sideways. Thrown off balance,
Ball cap hopped backward, arms pinwheeling. I scrambled to my feet and socked him with an elbow to the temple. He collapsed and lay still. My eyes roved wildly, saw no one else near. Ball cap lay face down, features hidden from view. I noted cowboy boots, tan with a green floral overlay and turquoise studs, a maroon tee, maybe Gamecocks, faded jeans. A heavy-duty mag light lay by the guy's right elbow. No file. No place it could be hidden on his person.
Shit on a stick.
The tee had ridden up, exposing a strip of pale, freckled skin. Vertebrae sharp as oyster shells, bulges in both back pockets. The pouch? Frisk the bastard? I felt fire in my ribs, a lump rising on my occipital. Oh, yeah. I inched close, snatched up the flash, and, alert to the faintest sign of returning consciousness, leaned down and dug the contents from the right jeans pocket. Three keys, one for a Chevy, two probably for doors. The left pocket produced a faux leather coin purse. Still no moaning, no movement. I pulled the purse's zipper tab. Inside was an impressive wad of cash, which I left in place. Folded around the bills, a note, which I opened. You find this, you want to live, phone the number below, now. I'm not fucking around. H. Kimry. The number had a 704 area code. My impulse was to kick H. Kimry in the nuts, to wake him and demand the folder in the pouch. A more rational voice overrode the fury. I stood a moment, watching the skinny chest rise and fall. The punk was breathing. Wary, I squatted to place a fingertip to his neck, felt a pulsing carotid, smelled boozy sweat. Tossing the maglite, the keys, and the purse with its cash, I scooped up my mobile and stuffed the note in my pocket. A quick scurry and dart search of the surrounding trees and brush, then I dashed for my car. Chapter 20. En route home, I charged my iPhone and dialed Slidell. After explaining my day and the attack by H. Kimry, I suggested he call Sheriff Poston. Skinny's rhetoric was all I'd imagined. When I arrived at the annex, the silver 4Runner was moored in the drive. Face crimson, Slidell launched himself from it and stormed toward me. His pants were brown, his socks orange. The ends of a green and rust tie hung to either side of his unbuttoned collar. I assumed he'd bumped up the couture for his visit with Jahan Cole's neighbor.
I don't believe it.
Practically spitting, he was so irate.
I don't freaking believe it.
Is it enough for a warrant? I weep-weeped my car.
Jesus Christ. You're a defense lawyer's wet dream, you know that?
Thus the need for a warrant, I said.
You got some kind of hearing disorder? That why you don't capiche what I tell you?
Bring it down, detective. I don't want you having a coronary in my yard.
Or maybe the problem's in your brain,
finger jabbing his temple.
Maybe you got some delusion. You're a TV dick, gonna get the big solve, and a fucking medal from the mayor?
I didn't acknowledge that Slidell might have a point. That he might have stumbled very close to the truth.
And no worries about me. My ticker's a beast.
I crossed the patio and let myself in. Slidell was right on my heels, smelling of temper and sweaty synthetics. Over the years, I'd come to recognize two things about Skinny. He can't stand being defied. He can't stand being bested. Today, his anger was springing from twin wells. Would you like a cold drink? Over my shoulder.
Gimme everything. Now. Maybe, just maybe, I can talk some asswipe judge into overlooking the fact that what I'm writing up wasn't even close to lawfully acquired, as in hot-fingered by a civilian out for a joyride. You going through some kind of mental thing? Even for you, your behavior lately has been plain nuts.
Another hard-earned insight. When Slidell does outrage, it's best to let him vent.
I'd troll through garbage, found evidence concerning missing kids, maybe the remains of one, lost most of that evidence, taken shots to my head and torso, and driven for almost 2 hours with sun in my eyes. I was grimy and hot and devoid of patience and hungry. Stop! Pivoting to face him, which sent pain spiking up my ribcage. Slidell glared, jaw muscles doing shotgun flexes. Have a seat. Lifting a ponytail that was plastered to my neck. I'll pour iced tea. He did. I did, after washing my hands. We both drank. Then I got latex gloves from my scene kit, donned one, handed the other to Slidell, and laid the note and the larger bone fragment on the table. Not sure why, but I left the smaller one in my pocket. Slidell eyed the glove, the note, and the bone, but touched nothing.
I'm supposed to applaud.
Did you run, Kimry? Ignoring his sarcasm. Slidell opened a picture on his phone and showed me the screen. It was a mugshot of the guy who'd leveled me. That's him, I said. Hunching a shoulder to blot sweat from his chin, Slidell slid a small spiral from his breast pocket, thumbed his tongue, and flipped pages.
34-year-old Caucasian, homeboy, managed to graduate from Northwest School of the Arts back in the day. Kid was some kind of violin prodigy.
A pause to decipher his notes, or triage what to hold back.
String of callers for dealing, soliciting, all small time, nothing violent. Did a couple stretches at Jail North, up on Spectre Drive.
I waited.
The H is for Hollister, goes by Holly, known as Molly Holly on the street. Apparently that's his specialty.
Slidell referred to the drug Molly, thought by some to be pure MDMA or ecstasy, but more commonly a toxic mixture of lab-made chemicals.
That and blow, acid, weed, you name it.
You alerted the sheriff? I asked.
Poston had one of his deputies swing by the property. Your guy was gone. Place was secure, no sign of forced entry, no response to his shouting.
I tried to recall if I'd properly closed the gate, if that was even possible, given that I'd found it open. Had no idea. Kimry must have come to and split.
You hit him that hard?
Impressed? I think he was drunk.
What the hell was he doing out there?
I had no answer to that. Have you traced the owners of the property?
It's a goddamn holding company. Individual names will be buried in reams of legal bullshit.
Gruff, but more controlled. Slidell had kicked into cop mode.
Did you spot a vehicle?
No, but I wasn't really looking. Remembering the faint, truncated whine. If Kimry came by motorcycle, I might not have seen it.
You're sure this Kimry snaked the pouch in the folder?
I think so. Slidell's face did something I couldn't really describe, but he didn't lambast me for my ineptitude.
Let's see the pics.
I watched Slidell swipe through the images, expanding some with an index finger and the spitty thumb. When finished,
send them to me.
I will.
Kimry works a patch off Eastway and Central.
Vodyanov had an apartment in a building near there. Did you get an LKA? I was asking about a last known address.
When I do, there's zero chance I'll be sharing it with you.
You'll bring Kimry in for questioning? You'll have to act fast. He could ditch the stuff or destroy it.
Never thought of that.
Birdie chose that moment to make his appearance. We both watched him slide around the doorframe, circle Slidell's ankles twice, then disappear into the pantry. For some reason, the cat is exceptionally fond of Skinny.
Why clip reports on missing kids?
Slidell has a habit of thinking out loud. He was doing that, but I answered anyway. I don't know.
Why toss them now?
We don't know how long they were in the dumpster.
You're sure the pouch held kids' teeth?
I nodded.
They were at the incinerator.
Yes.
Why weren't they toast?
Raccoons. Slidell raised quizzical brows. I'm guessing wet garbage was allowed to pile up, then haul to the incinerator,
Maybe some was taken straight out there. Either way, the coons hit before the next burn.
And one of them dragged the bone back under the netting.
Chin-cocking at the fragment.
Seems so.
Why would this Yahoo Kimry snatch the shit you collected?
I don't know. I was saying that a lot.
Is it human?
I tipped frustrated palms.
DNA clear that up?
Yes, but you know how long it takes.
Slidell ran a hand down his face and leaned back.
How was your interview with a coal neighbor? I asked.
Colorful.
Meaning?
Her name's Cootie Clanahan. She hates Trump, loves Pearl Jam, NASCAR, and the White Sox.
Really?
And roses. Smelled like I was sitting in a goddamn funeral parlor.
What did she tell you?
Not touching the odd metaphor.
She remembers a car circling the block the night before the coal kid vanished. Says it was a 2007 Ford Mustang forest green with a hinky front. The old gals batshit into cars because of the NASCAR thing.
Hinky?
Had some kind of custom grill work? She showed me in Road and Track what the 07 Mustang looks like coming off the line. She subscribes, you believe that?
Impressive.
Gotta admit, she seemed solid, weird but solid. She also said something got my attention.
I waited while Slidell chugged more tea.
There's a park at the end of the street where the Coles were living. Clanahan could see it from her front window. I'm guessing she spent a lot of hours with her nose to the glass. Anyway, she remembers a guy hanging around about that same time. Said he looked hinky.
Odd grill work?
You want to practice your stand-up, or should I go on?
I gestured for him to continue.
She says she saw this guy talking to Jahan and some other kids.
Did she report that?
When the cops didn't call her back about the Mustang, she dropped it. Then she moved away. Here's the thing. A couple of months ago, a man came to see her. She found it weird that he'd tracked her down so long after the kid went missing, so she made an entry in her diary. I forgot to mention, Cootie's writing her memoirs. That's how she could remember all this detail about the vehicle. The guy claimed to be a cop, but she said he looked hinky.
I refrained from comment.
I've scoured the file. There's no mention of any follow-up to Clanahan's call. So that part tracks. Nothing about running down a tip on a Mustang. But back in the spring, when she says she was contacted, the case was colder than a nun's tit.
No one was conducting interviews at that time.
No one was doing jack shit.
Did the hinky cop look like the guy in the park?
She wasn't sure.
Okay. I said, not knowing what else to say.
Okay.
For several seconds, the only sound was Birdie messing with something in the pantry. What's up with the Hyundai from Arts Affordable? I asked.
As I suspected, Poston turned it over to us, dickwads to...
And?
Forensics found nada.
No trace? No prints?
Wiped clean. Ditto the duffel and the stuff inside. Car's registered to John Ito. Fake name, fake address. Dead end.
What's happening with the notebook?
Peppers is holding it up in QD. Apparently we've got no Latvian translator, so she's waiting on you for that.
I'll phone Pete again. He's been out of town. But I'll bet the farm the Estonia references are just notes on another conspiracy theory.
Slidell nodded.
Now what? I asked. First, I tag and bag your bone and drop it by the lab.
It's probably non-human, locking eyes with Slidell. He got my meaning.
So the ME don't need to be involved. Then I pry a judge away from his Sunday night gin.
We absolutely have to get into that bunker, fast.
Don't get your skivvies in a twist. Assuming I score a warrant, and that's a big-ass assumption, I'm not about to go off half-cocked.
I've left a message with a realtor who specializes in these abandoned military structures.
You're shitting me.
I'll ring him again, and I'll do more cyber research. I'll run Kimry to ground. Meanwhile, I want you.
Slidell pushed to his feet, head wagging glumly.
Why do I even bother?
Call me the minute you find him.
Yeah, you're topping my dance card.
After Slidell left, I showered, shampooed, and dug sooty mud from under my nails. The bruise on my left side was congealing like the thunderheads before Friday's storm. Cleaner and decidedly more fragrant, I defrosted a Stouffer's spaghetti dinner and ate while Googling Timothy Horshauser. His story was given less attention than many child disappearances, but the circumstances were painfully familiar. On May 22, 2014, 9-year-old Timothy John Horshauser vanished while waiting for a school bus in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. Horshauser's parents were divorced. Janelle Horshauser was an RN, raising her son solo. Paul Horshauser was an auto mechanic, remarried, and living in upstate New York. Timmy went missing while under the care of his maternal aunt, Bridget England. As was their routine, England made breakfast for her nephew so her sister could leave for a morning shift at the local hospital. Just past 7 a.m., England drove Timmy to the bus stop, then continued on to her job as a seamstress at an alteration business. Timmy was the first to arrive at the stop. No one recalled seeing him boarding or riding the bus. He did not appear at school that day. He was never seen again. A massive search turned up neither the child nor his remains. The usual persons were investigated: known sex offenders, teachers, family members, coaches, bus drivers, everyone in the boy's life. No suspect was ever identified or charged. The clipped article had appeared in the Uniontown Herald Standard. Outside the kid's hometown, there had been minimal statewide and no national coverage. I sent an email to Slidell, sharing what I'd learned, and reminding him about the papers from the trench coat lining that he'd forgotten to take. Next, I researched iPhone blackouts and poor battery life. Found numerous opinions that the poor performance might be resulting from inadequate memory due to storage of too many images. I checked. My geriatric device was juggling 33,207 stills and 297 videos. Pure laziness. I didn't need memories of Halloween 2002 at my fingertips. But what to do? Put everything in the cloud, as most cyber nerds were suggesting? Many of the photos were of sensitive case material, including several still in litigation. Were my pictures more secure in cyberspace or on my laptop, which I alone controlled? Not knowing the legal restraints concerning image retention, I'd done no cloud backups. Uncertain about the answer and wanting to be totally safe, I transferred everything to my laptop for temporary storage. Then I Googled instructions on how to delete all data in my phone's library. With great trepidation, I carried them out. That done, I turned to the newly stored images on my Mac. I didn't really expect to hear from Slidell. Still, every few minutes, I glanced up to check the time. With my mobile in camera mode, I'd been unable to use the flashlight app while under the camo netting. Shooting blind hadn't gone well. Many images were badly framed, out of focus, or too dim to make out the subject. But now and then, I'd nailed it. An empty Campbell's tomato soup can. A crumpled Doritos bag. A child's neon pink sneaker. Uptick in my pulse. Focus. Maybe because my movement was constricted by the size of the opening, maybe because the light from my flash was trapped inside the bin, the objects in the dumpster were captured with crystal clarity. Still life trash in an inky sea. I was working through that series when my eyes fell on a tangled washcloth flaring white amid the jumbled fill. Stitched across it was a line of blue script. Deep Haven. The logo or name of a towel manufacturer? A place? Maybe a resort or hotel? Google produced links to several possibilities. A town in Minnesota, a mortgage company, a family camp in New Hampshire, a series of romance novels. I explored the camp, followed links to every business in Deep Haven, Minnesota, looped through Zillow listings of real estate on Deephaven Courts, Deephaven Lanes, and Deephaven Roads across the country. Nothing seemed promising. But repetition has its rewards. Seeing the name over and over triggered memories of my foray down into the dark web. Deephaven, on a face cloth, in a bunker, near the creek where Felix Vodyanov's mutilated body was found. Deep under, Vodyanov, Yates Timmer, and Nick Boddy, together at an MK Ultra and Mind Control conference in 2010. I don't believe in coincidence. Switching to the Tor browser, I took another plunge down the deep under vortex. This time, instead of choosing one of the tabs, I typed Nick Boddy into the search box beside the black and red banner. The screen darkened, swirled like ink spinning down a drain, then filled with a long list of text. I scrolled through it, found nothing but links to Boddy's podcasts and blogs. A low-level headache sent feelers up the back of my skull. A migraine? Nope. Wrong cranial zip code. I tried the name Felix Vodyanov. The cursor blinked, puzzled or defiant. Yates Timmer. More swirling. Slowly the page loaded. Three URLs were listed: Homes at the End of the World, LLP, and World's End House. Familiar with those, I went for the third. And found myself reading a full-screen infomercial, an ad touting the desirability of underground living and promising the investment opportunity of a lifetime. An Atlas F missile site in upstate New York backlit the bold black message in pastoral greens and blues. Interested parties were encouraged to contact Yates Timmer by phone. The number was the one at which I'd left my voicemail. At the bottom of the page, in extraordinarily wee font, was the surprising invitation. Qualified individuals are invited to Deephaven. An address was provided in GPS coordinates: 35 degrees 20 minutes 0 seconds north, 80 degrees 59 minutes 58 seconds west. Beside the address, blank rectangles requested a username and password. Knowing it was the longest of long shots, I checked my images and began with the passcode scribbled on the folded scrap. RABUK 1973, DALIHP 2580, UATNOM 1739. No winner there. Then, though hopeless, I began entering random combinations: Timmer, Boddy, Vodyanov, World's End, MK Ultra, Boddy Language. I'd been at it several minutes when the screen went black. A beat, then I was bounced to the Tor homepage. I'd been ejected. I returned to Deep Under and entered the password I'd been using. No go. I unplugged the modem to obtain a new IP address and adjusted settings. Repeated the process several times, with no success. I'd been barred from the site. Busted? If so, what had they learned about me? And how? Had my laptop been hijacked? Altered to permit a remote user to spy on me with my own camera? To secretly record me? I'd read about such hackers, and there was that FaceTime bug that allowed anyone to make a group call, add their own number, and gain access to audio and video of the recipient without the recipient's knowledge. Had Apple fixed that? Had I downloaded the update? I powered down, slammed the lid, and yanked the plug. Irrational, I knew, but my frustration and anxiety were stratospheric, and the throbbing in my side and up my neck and occipital wasn't helping. To calm my frazzled nerves and battered ribs, I took a very long, very hot bath. Then, fingers pruny, body smelling of honey apple blossom lotion, I crawled into bed and dialed Ryan. No answer. I left a message. It was too late to call anyone else. On impulse, I downloaded a new ringtone. Sleep eluded me for a very long time. Finally, spurred by some impulse I couldn't explain, I got up, crossed to my dresser, and searched a drawer two-handed in the dark. Found the object I was seeking. Smooth and round, with a plump belly, long trunk, and one broken tusk. Returning to bed, I set the little elephant-headed figure on the bedside table and stared into his eyes. He stared back. Ganesha, the god of beginnings, the remover of obstacles. Somehow, I felt lighter. When Bertie curled at my knee, I stroked his back and explained why I'd been so tense of late. Tomorrow was Monday, I assured him. A new week. Things would improve. A breakthrough in the case was imminent. A new beginning. I was wrong. Life was about to go from bad to pure hell. Chapter 21. Monday, July 9th. I woke to Bob Marley urging me to chill. My eyes flew to the clock. 9:48. Impossible. 'Cause every little thing gonna be all right. I grabbed my mobile. Slidell was already talking when it hit my ear. Benchlug says it ain't enough. I should... A judge refused to issue a warrant? Over-enunciating to sound fully awake. According to her thinking, which is on par with my cousin Blanton's senile gerbil, undocumented photos, a bone of dubious origin, and a hearsay tale don't constitute probable cause. Damn. She suggested, not so politely, I come back with more. Then we'll do that. We? I don't recall you standing there getting your head handed. I told him about the washcloth, Deep Haven, the GPS coordinates buried in Timmer's ad. I'm sure you looked him up. Not yet. I didn't mention my ouster from Deep Under and the subsequent paranoia that my Mac was now spying on me. But I'm conversant enough to know the location is just south of Charlotte. You think it's some kind of real estate office? If so, Timmer's not putting it out high profile. You say this yak's hawking old missile sites. Maybe a buyer's got to be vetted to get the inside skinny. That made sense. What's up with Kimry? I asked. In the wind. I'll get him. Find anything more on Vodyanov? Nada. It's like the skank never existed. I checked records for the unit in Ramos's building. You're right, the tenant in number 6 had no cable, no phone, no internet. Swung by for a chat with the landlady. There's a piece of work. Ramos claims she hardly ever saw the guy. Got the same story from a neighbor. Pages flipped. Hugo Garcia. Looks like Vodyanov used the place as a drop, maybe a safe house. Drop for what? Safe from what? Who the hell knows? Why swab the apartment with antiseptic? Same answer. I changed gears. What about Cootie Clanahan's Mustang lead?
Got someone helping me dig through DMV records, licenses, registration, citations, the usual. The CCU ain't overstaffed, so it's probably going to take the rest of our lives.
I could hear the frustration in his voice. How about the holding company that owns the property?
Working on that, too.
30 minutes later, Marley sang again. I recognized the number. I'd worked at that end of the line for decades. Good morning. Uber cheerful. This is not a social call. Hevner's tone was overtly hostile. It's still a good morning, I chirped. I thought I was explicit in asking that you refrain from interfering in cases assigned to my office. You received my second email. It seems I have not made myself clear. Did you follow up on the Vodyanov ID? How the hell did you obtain a sample for DNA testing? Did I explain that Detective Slidell and I tossed Vodyanov's car and confiscated personal items? True, but irrelevant. I wanted to divert Hevner. The dodge worked. I have no obligation to disclose this to you. I do so to demonstrate the inappropriateness of your behavior. Meaningful pause. There is no record of a Felix Vodyanov ever having been a guest at Sparkling Waters Ashram. There is no record of Dr. Yuryev treating such a person. He probably registered under the name of F. Vance, devoid of chirp, more than once. glacial silence. Ask Yuryev. Give him a call. Do not tell me how to do my job. I'm sorry, I wasn't. Dr. Brennan, your actions amount to more than simple interference. What you are doing may rise to the level of obstruction. I am seeking advice concerning legal action against you. In the meantime, I am lodging ethics complaints with both the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the American Board of Forensic Anthropology. Because I've made the only breakthrough in your case? Your actions were unauthorized and may have compromised an official death investigation. My input was sought by a member of the CMPD cold case unit. Not exactly. Really? Disdainful snort. The only thing cold in this case is the stiff. That stiff, as you so crudely refer to a human being, may be linked to a number of child disappearances. And to the rabbit assassinated at the Circle K? Ignoring Hevner's sarcasm. How did Vidyanov die? Silly question, even if she knew she wasn't going to tell me. That does not concern you. Did you run a full talk screen? Further questioning was certain to annoy her more, but I couldn't help myself. That information is confidential. Are you engaging a board-certified anthropologist other than myself? Not needed. A moment of chilly nothing filled the line. No clanking or buzzing, none of the familiar autopsy room sounds. I pictured Hevner in Larrabee's office. He'd hung a Peter Max poster behind the desk. I wondered what she had gracing the wall. When angered, one's heart rate, arterial tension, and testosterone production increase. The stress hormone cortisol decreases, and the left brain hemisphere goes all twitchy. The thought of Dr. Morgue in Larrabee's space triggered the whole raucous circus. It's been 10 days, I snapped. If you had cause of death, you'd have staged another of your alpha dog performances. That's your specialty, right? Playing the media for personal glorification? How dare you? You better believe I dare. Blood was exploding into the tiny vessels in my cheeks. I dare to get this man identified. I dare to pursue even the faintest glimmer of a lead concerning the fate of these missing kids. Hevner shifted the phone and spoke to someone. A male voice responded. When her mouth returned to the receiver, there is no point in further discussion. I drew a hot breath to respond. Hevner cut me off. But bear in mind one truth, Dr. Brennan. I am the alpha dog. Abrupt disconnect. I sat quite a while, face flaming, trying to recover the decades of professionalism I'd mislaid during that brief conversation. The torture continued all day. At noon, it was Pete. He was back in Charlotte and had news that could only be relayed in person. He was solemn and engaged in none of his usual banter or teasing. His tone frightened me. Beyond saying that the topic had nothing to do with Katie, no amount of wheedling could get him to expand. I agreed to dinner the following night. Then it was Mama. She and Sinich had booked a trip to Bhutan to work on their spirituality and wellness and to reconsider the concept of weddings. When pressed for specifics, she said they'd be visiting Buddhist meditation centers and undergoing hot springs therapy. When I asked if these centers could accommodate her chemo regime, she assured me all would be fine. Far from reassured, I phoned her doctor's office. The switchboard directory made me certain my brain was dribbling right out of my ear. I left a message with a bot in a basement cubbyhole entered through a secret door in an abandoned cutlery closet. Disconnecting, I wondered, was it my fault? Had I mentioned the ashram to her? Thought not, but couldn't be sure. I checked my email, hoping for a consult request, which would mean a bit of additional income. Found none. At one point, I considered a trip to the Apple store, but couldn't muster the energy. Another truth about me, I hate malls and waiting in lines. And there was the budgetary issue. After phoning the painter and the electrician again, I spent time catching up on neglected paperwork. As the afternoon wore on, A troubling question percolated up through my agitation. Given Hevner's obvious hostility, why had she shared any information at all? Was her uncharacteristic collegiality spurred by an ulterior motive? Dribble Brennan a few crumbs, let her crack the case, then Dr. Morg can swoop in and grab credit for the solve? Around 5, after placing duct tape over my laptop's camera lens, I logged onto WebMD and typed in the term taphophobia. Consistent with Asia Barrow's characterization, the condition was defined as the irrational fear of being buried alive, sometimes the fear of interment resulting from a false pronouncement of death. The site also offered these tidbits. Taphophobia can originate from childhood experiences involving actual entrapment or from viewing depictions of such situations. Sufferers may avoid enclosed buildings, fearing collapse. Some refuse anesthesia, fearing they'll be wrongly declared dead and buried. Exacerbating factors include other mental disorders and substance abuse. Felix Vodianov was being treated for taphophobia? Then why live underground? After a foodie call dinner of lamb korma, much appreciated by Bertie, I tried reading. My theory was solid. Escape into a world I could leave whenever I chose. My carry-through was lacking. Anger and frustration had me jittery and unable to focus. Just past 6, Marley announced yet another caller. Blocked number. Thinking my anxiety couldn't possibly increase, maybe hoping to unload on some unsuspecting telemarketer, I answered. I'm trying to reach Dr. Temperance Brennan. Male, unfamiliar. This is she. I work for the Charlotte Observer. I already have a subscription. I'm sorry, I should have made myself clear. I'm a reporter. What's your name? Wary. I knew most of those on the crime beat. Gerald Brueger. Jerry, the lizard asking questions at Hevner's press conference. You're a freelancer, I said. You're not actually employed by the Observer. Yes, but they often publish my pieces. How did you get this number? I have my ways. I said nothing. I've just had a long conversation with Dr. Margot Hevner. Bully for you. Have a good life. Please don't hang up. For some reason, I didn't. An instinct for self-preservation? I'm doing a story on the state of forensic science in North Carolina, Brueger said. My lead-in will be the case of the corpse eaten by hogs out in Cleveland County. I'm wondering if you'd like to make a statement. Rethink your use of the term eaten. Go on. I'm done. Is it true the body is still unidentified? No comment. The cause of death is unknown? No comment. That the ME refuses to bring you in on the case? No comment. Is it true that Dr. Hevner is filing complaints against you? Who told you that? You know I can't reveal my sources. You and your sources can take a flying fuck off my backyard fence. I regularly do stories for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Daily Beast. I have those numbers right here in my contacts. The implied threat sent the three-ring emotional circus into hyperdrive. My thumb mashed so hard to disconnect I nearly dropped the phone. Sitting there, coaxing my pulse back down into the normal range, I was hit by a sudden recollection from Hevner's presser. She'd addressed only one journalist by name. Jerry Brueger. I was considering the significance of that when Marley sang again. This time I checked. Area code 514. I pictured a different desk, a different office. Dr. Pierre Lamanche, directeur, on a plaque by the door.
Bonjour, comme ça va?
I answered.
Très bien, merci.
Lamanche switched to English, as precise as his French. I apologize for contacting you so late. It's good to hear your voice.
You are unwell?
My boss for decades at the Laboratoire de Sciences Judiciaires et de Médecine Légale, Lamanche was uncanny at interpreting the subtlest of nuances in my mood. I'm fine.
Ah, Temperance, you sound peine.
Pained? Distressed? Either way, he'd nailed it.
I have a lot on my mind.
Such a veil of woes in which we ply our trade. But I am an old wagon, all rusty metal and squeaky wheels. You are young. You should be happy.
The sad metaphor did little to raise my spirits. What's up?
A subpoena has arrived for you.
Do you recall the Pescarol case?
Of course.
Dorothée Pescarol vanished while walking home from an outdoor performance of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra. 8 days later, her decomposed body was found in a hockey bag, tossed up on the shore of the St. Lawrence River. The concert had been organized to honor the city's 375th birthday. Dorothée hadn't lived to see her 17th. The investigation resulted in the arrest of her ex-fiancé.
The trial is scheduled to begin next week. Jury selection is expected to conclude on Tuesday at the latest. Your availability is ordered beginning on Wednesday.
Okay. It was so far from okay, I couldn't fathom a device capable of doing the math. I have placed the subpoena on your desk. Thanks.
There are several demande expertise forms there with it, par d'urgence, on those cases.
I'll reserve a flight.
A bientôt.
Oui. See you soon. I returned to the book, again planning to lose myself in 1930s New Guinea, again failing. The subpoena imposed a new urgency. I had to leave for Montreal no later than Tuesday. Yet Felix Vodianov remained on his gurney. The same old question spun in my off-kilter brain. Had Vodianov been stalking me shortly before his death? If so, why? How had he found me? What had he wanted to tell me? An image of the severed goose head congealed on the unread page. I thought of the flock struggling to cling to its turf, a metaphor more apt than La Manche's wagon. Like the geese, I was fighting to save my career, to return from exile. Was that it? Was my motive purely self-interest? Or did I truly care about justice for Felix Vodianov, for the kids he may have harmed? Was Vodianov a victim or an offender? On and on, round and round. Slidell's failure to obtain a warrant, Hevner's determination to ruin me professionally, Mama's cavalier, perhaps lethal, attitude toward her chemo, Jerry Bruger's knowledge of Hevner's crusade against me and possible intent to assist in that campaign. How much did Bruger know? His call, more than anything, had driven home the precariousness of my situation. Should Hevner's charges actually stick, Bruger would be on the story like jackals on a carcass. While dodging his questions, I'd visualized a predator. What the hell was up with Pete? And always, when would the next migraine slam me to the boards? Or worse, a vascular assault. If the tiny bubble did burst, how bad would it be? A stray thought caused a sharp intake of breath. Slidell was right. I was acting much more rashly of late, taking far more risks, tailing the trench-coated prowler at Sharon Hall, sneaking illicit photos and samples from the faceless man at the MCME, interviewing Barrow, Ramos, and Kiesing alone, exploring the Cleveland County properties solo. Did this recent recklessness arise from a newborn sense of my own mortality? One day the aneurysm may burst, so what the hell? I rolled the idea around, testing to see if the epiphany had legs. Could my rogue-ass cowboying be a subliminal reaction to the prospect of my own death? Or was my furious intensity on this case just a variation on my usual commitment to anonymous victims, to the possibility of wronged children or children in danger? Why all the goddamn introspection? Self-analysis is not a game I enjoy or one at which I excel. Tossing the book across the room, I got up to pace, sat down, got up again to retrieve the book and flatten the pages. I felt useless, but too restless to stay still. By 8, I was absolutely wild with nerves. Slidell hadn't phoned, there were no new leads, those that we had were going nowhere, the clock was ticking. I imagined I was trapped in a pressure cooker with no steam vent. Vowing to take no action without consulting Slidell,